Hello and welcome back to another edition of Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. The world is changing around us so fast it's hard to keep up, isn't it? I saw a fabulous cartoon the other day with two New Yorkers walking down the street, and the one says, "My desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to stay sane." And I thought that was very funny and terrifying at the same time. There's just so much going on, what with US President Donald Trump starting a historically large trade war and with the whole world except Russia, note, and our own government, the GNU, or Government of National Unity, tearing itself apart. The RAND has tanked spectacularly. The JSU All-Share Index, although recovering a bit at the start of the week, as people bought into the dip, is down almost 10,000 points at one stage. The yield on the main local 10-year bond, this is a function of how expensive it is for us to service our debt, is at its highest in a decade, apart from a brief peak at the start of the COVID pandemic. The government's going to struggle to find answers to events abroad over which it has no control, but there's little doubt that the political instability here at home is also contributing to market and social anxiety. The GNU is on the verge, it seems, of collapse over the refusal by the DA, the second largest party in the GNU, to support an increase in VAT in the budget. It's ignited a war for control of the GNU, with arguments in the DA and the larger ANC, both for and against the DA remaining in the government, despite opposing the budget. One way or another, this week is going to be, it seems, decisive. Business, for its part, is super keen for the GNU to remain intact, and I'm very happy to have as my guest today one of our best-known business leaders, Martin Kingston. Martin is the chairman of Rothschilds in South Africa and also leader of B4SA, arguably the business group with the most clout among CEOs of big businesses in South Africa. Martin, thanks very much for joining me. And can I start by recognizing that your name was on a letter sent last week by business to the ANC and the DA, urging them to stay in the room and not to break the GNU, but also that it was a private letter and that we're not going to talk about the letter in this discussion. But I can still ask you, Martin, more generally, why business would want the GNU to survive in the first place? The parties distrust each other, and the ANC surely has a point when it asks how a coalition member can remain in the tent after having voted against its budget.
So, good afternoon, Peter, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss that and no doubt other issues. So my starting point really is, and you refer to it in the context of what we're seeing happening in the US, and obviously that has implications for the world and indeed for South Africa, is high levels of volatility and lack of predictability. The partnership that we have formed with government, and if you cast your mind back, you'll remember that Business for South Africa was established as an all-of-business response to work alongside government and other social partners in the pandemic. So now actually coming up for 5 years ago, and that was a successful partnership. It sort of obviously then pivoted to the vaccination rollout in 2021. And for the last 2 years, we've been working in partnership with them, covering key issues that constrain economic growth. And our really sort of substantive, you know, issue and guiding light is inclusive economic growth that can address the levels of employment or indeed unemployment in the country and provide the right basis for South Africa to achieve its potential, something it's manifestly failed to do for several years. And putting that partnership in place required a high level of commitment, both from the government of the day, at the time it was the ANC government, but also, of course, business as well at the highest level, and I'm sure we'll interrogate that. When the GNU was formed in the wake of the elections, we welcomed the GNU. We welcomed it because, as far as we're concerned, as I've said, we work with the government of the day with some provisos. The proviso, obviously, is that our support is accepted and recognized as being sort of assistance to achieve key goals. And the key goals really are the implementation of structural reform in such a way that the private sector can play an appropriate role across all spheres of the economy. And I stress the word appropriate because we think that that is absolutely critical to inclusive, sustainable economic growth, investment, and ultimately, of course, the creation of jobs. And so if there are political parties that subscribe to those values, we welcome them as our counterpart in government. And if there are parties that do not subscribe to their values, then we obviously will not be able to mobilize the resources, the commitment, and the support that I've referred to before. We don't have a view, Peter, on the composition of the GNU other than within those sort of broad parameters, if I can put it that way. Having said all of that, I think that it is absolutely clear, and you talked about it in your introduction, that a potential dissolution of the GNU creates huge instability and uncertainty within the markets and actually much more broadly within South Africa. And that cannot be in our best interest, let alone in a set of circumstances where we're seeing unprecedented levels, I would argue, of volatility and lack of predictability worldwide.
Martin, thanks. But the you know, just to come back to the point, you're not saying you don't care who's made up who makes up the GNU, provided more or less their principles align with yours. But the issue at the moment is quite serious, isn't it? Not. I mean, the possibility that the DA may leave the coalition government is very real, as far as I can see, even this morning and this early afternoon. What's the best way of asking this question? It must be of real concern to business that a business-friendly party, as the DA is, finds it impossible or to stay in the GNU, or that the government, the ANC, much reduced though it may be, finds it impossible to work with a business-friendly party because it wants to share power or too much power or whatever the argument ends up having been. Are you able to play as business a constructive role in resolving this, or is it not your business?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Peter, because there's been much speculation and debate about the appropriateness of business intervening. We're not actually intervening at all. What we're saying is that we think that we need to have a government in place which has, if you like, on a collective basis, the majority of the seats in Parliament, and that's what we have at the moment, and that government needs within its ranks to have people and indeed parties that subscribe to fundamental structural reform. That's the first point. I'll come back to that if I may. And secondly, that acknowledges that there's a significant role for the business community, large and small, informal and formal, to play in driving economic growth within the country. And I have to say that without a government that is able to control that process, and control by definition means more than 50% is not a minority government, we are going to have problems. We have failed to make the progress as a country that we could and should have made over the last several years. And what we've seen in the context of the partnership and indeed Operation Vulindlela has been a sort of a significant increase in momentum and indeed in demonstrating that we can make progress. Now, I happen to be of the view that many of the people, and this is a personal view, many of the people within cabinet, either from the ANC or indeed from the DA, absolutely subscribe to the philosophy that I've just articulated. And, you know, whomsoever holds those ministerial posts, their successors, we would believe, have to have a similar role. Now, as far as the DA being part or not of the GNU is concerned, what we have observed to date has been a highly productive and constructive partnership between ourselves and the GNU, where we've had ministers from both the ANC and the DA across the table from ourselves in particular, but not only in the meetings that are ultimately chaired by the president. And it's much better in our view, in the current circumstances, to stay the course and maintain the progress that we've begun to see than to change in midstream. But having said that, I think that we acknowledge two things, Peter. The first is, ultimately, it's the president's prerogative to appoint who he likes, and indeed for the parties to the GNU to agree or to disagree as to whether or not they can work with one another. We are deeply concerned that if there's going to be either a minority government or a change in the composition of the GNU that undermines either certainty, confidence, predictability, and confidence levels, I would argue, are now actually very thin, as opposed to having been in a very sort of good place relative to previous years, or where we can't see the sort of reforms that are required taking place, then of course we're allowed to express our opinion. What we're not going to do is apply pressure, as has been sort of suggested, to any of the parties. That, in my opinion, is wholly inappropriate.
Yeah. So the progress that you're seeing now, Martin, you say you've been for many years chasing, structural reform and growth, and suddenly you're seeing progress. It's either because Vulindlela, Operation Vulindlela, is working. This is its operation inside the presidency, designed to, I think it's a cooperation between the Treasury and the presidency, designed to foster and stimulate growth. Or is it the presence of the DA? Because the DA is fairly new to all of this. Were you not making progress before the DA, or are you making more progress now because the DA is there?
So you're absolutely right. Vulindlela, of course, was a construct of the sixth administration. So that was an ANC majority government, housed, as you say, equally as a partnership between the presidency and National Treasury within the presidency, which looked at structural reform. And we as business had already started working closely with Operation Vulindlela. What we did in the context of the current partnership was we identified three primary constraints, as you and I have discussed before: energy, transport and logistics, and crime and corruption, which actually act as very significant impediments on economic growth, and saw how we could mobilize skills, resources, and, if you like, experience to work either on the side of business in partnership with and in support of government, or indeed to deploy them or to if you like, contribute them to government, which we've done through the Resource Mobilization Fund, so that they're appropriately capacitated. Because I think that it is not controversial to say that capacity constraints in government have been one of the inhibitors of the progress that we need to make. And the president has been, again, very clear and consistent about those capacity constraints. At all times doing it at arm's length, at all times doing it recognizing that we shouldn't, in any circumstances, put ourselves in a position where there's inappropriate conflict of interest between business and the work that they are doing. So you're absolutely right. That work had commenced. We'd seen traction long before the DA joined government. What we found with the DA joining is that they have simply reinforced that commitment to structural reform, and we welcome that. We think they're a good counterweight in terms of what are, for the most part, I would argue, as you said, business-friendly policies and a business-friendly approach. Of course, we are keen to see that influence continuing. And the counterweight is a good thing in a country which is as complex and with as many contradictory priorities, if I can put it that way, as exist. In the final analysis, though, we have never profiled ourselves as working with the DA. We're working with the government any more than we said we were working with the ANC.
Yeah.
And that will continue to be our stance, whether the DA, are part of the GNU, or indeed whether the ANC is part of the GNU. We would much rather that, actually, in terms of the issues, those are resolved quickly between the parties concerned. And I understand that that is the intention, at least as announced by the Secretary General of the ANC earlier today, that they're going to try and find a way in which parties in the GNU, he wasn't explicit and specific, can move forward in a collaborative sense.
Yeah. So I've got you right then. So whether or not the DA stays in government, the Operation Vulindlela goes forward with your support and participation. I just have to ask myself, because of this crisis that's happening locally, perhaps we'd be better off with a government without the DA in it, and with a very small majority, two or whatever, however they manage to cobble it together, perhaps the DA back in opposition with a confidence and supply arrangement, which, it would have offered, which was one of the options it faced after the election. I worry that if it stays in the government after this crisis, that we'll be back in another one in no time. There'll be another tipping point. There'll be another cliff edge to go and, get all anxious and hang ourselves by our fingernails on. And I wonder whether that's worth it. It's exhausting.
Well, it is exhausting. But what is even more exhausting, Peter, is when we don't have the confidence that the government that is responsible for the oversight of the country doesn't have, if you like, control of and the ability to implement its own policies. So a wafer-thin majority is obviously a cause for concern. Now, as you say, there were very many models that were considered before the GNU was formed, one of which, of course, was the confidence and supply arrangement to which you refer. So what I was suggesting was that that was one of the models that was looked at, of course, in the negotiations after the elections. And what the investor community requires, and I believe that business for South Africa represents not just the investor community, but society more broadly in terms of our sort of economic aspirations, if I can put it that way, is the confidence that key policies are going to be the subject of appropriate structural reform, that those decisions are taken and are subsequently implemented. And we as business, to the extent that government is willing, whoever is in government, are happy to work alongside and in support of that government in the provision of skills, experience, resource, insight. What investors require is predictability as well as the certainty that structural reform will be implemented. I don't believe that it is in the country's interest that there are significant doubts in the minds of investors, domestic or international, that either key decisions will not be taken on a timeous basis or implemented with the requisite capacity and with the requisite commitment.
Martin, I mean, so the thing is, I guess, if you're the DA, is, you know, your business's outlook is much more short-term than if you're, you know, your CEOs are chasing quarterly earnings targets or whatever they may be. The DA or any political party is looking towards 2026 elections and 2029 elections. What they do now is going to be very critical to what happens to them in those elections. And I wonder whether it's unfair to expect the DA to stay in a government in which it's manifestly unwelcome.
Well, I think that if the DA feels unwelcome and unappreciated, then the DA will no doubt in due course take, you know, its decision as to whether or not it can stay or whether it should return to the opposition benches. I actually don't think that that's the issue here. I think I'm now talking about in terms of the issue between the ANC and the DA. What we need in a set of, surely what we need, Peter, in a set of circumstances where no party, no single party has a majority, is that there is a model for co-governing. There may be a junior or senior partner in the government. We see it. It's not as though we don't see these arrangements around the world, which have carefully thought through how they can co-govern and where there are issues of principle which they don't agree with one another about, that they either carve those out in an appropriate way or they have some sort of resolution mechanism which can address those points of difference. And my own assessment, Peter, you would know better than I, is that actually in the time frame that was available to put the GNU together, those issues were not properly considered. And so there's actually nothing that's on the table that is new that we didn't know about prior to the creation of the GNU. So if it is for the sake of the DA issues that they articulate with respect to the Bella Act or with respect to NHI, those are two well-rehearsed issues, then those should have been either carved out or made the subject of specific arrangements, you know, at the time of the formation of the GNU. You know, they were not. What we are looking for as business is a government that is capable of taking decisions and implementing those decisions. I just need to come back by May to a point that you made, which I, am I allowed to disagree with you? I would disagree with you about.
I
don't think that, and we have got now 150 plus CEOs that have signed up to this process. They are not, and many of them are directly involved in the work concerned, from the CEO of FirstRand, Mary Vilakazi, to the CEO of Anglo American, you know, Duncan Wamblat, to the CEO of Sasol, across the breadth of the economy. I don't believe they're chasing, in the context of the partnership, quarterly earnings. I think that they recognize that they have a major a major investment in and commitment to South Africa, which they want to protect for all of their stakeholders. Their stakeholders includes, by the way, the societies that they serve, the employees that they have working for them, the shareholders ultimately that they account to, but society at large, if you like. They know full well that the work that we're doing is painstaking and time-consuming and will only really show results in the medium term, not in the immediate short term. So I think that there's an absolute alignment. Yeah. But Peter, if we don't take those decisions, let's say about opening up the energy sector or the transport and logistics sector to private sector participation in an appropriately regulated form, and that's hugely complicated, as you know, we have to start with a commitment to put in place the necessary both processes and the regulatory environment to enable that to happen. That is a lengthy process, and they all understand that. I don't think that they are driven by short-term measures. Where they are driven by short-term measures is if there is huge instability or volatility in the currency, in the markets, and that is in part due to government's action or inaction, then I think that, of course, they have every reason to be concerned and to express that. That's their short-term considerations.
And you'd agree with me, Martin, that part of what is happening at the moment, while most of it may be down to Donald Trump's trade war, part of what's happening is also down to the tensions inside the GNU and our own internal domestic policy, conflicts.
I fully agree with you. Just as Donald Trump's trade war and his very particular targeting of South Africa has a very direct impact upon both confidence levels and how markets respond in a narrow sense towards South Africa.
No, absolutely. And look, I take completely what you mean about CEOs. They're not all chasing quarterly earnings targets, but I think the timeframes of business and of political parties are by definition going to be different. I mean, the DA and the ANC as well and all the other parties are looking forward to elections 4, 5, 6 years hence. And they need to develop track records so that when they finally get to put themselves before the voters, they've got something to say. I wanted just to ask you personally, Martin, what did you think of the pitch that the DA made during this negotiation? Did you think they overplayed their hand? Do you think that what they were looking for, they were chasing growth and reforms? Do you think they were being reasonable? What do you think of the DA's position as a very experienced businessman in the affairs of, in the political economy generally?
Yeah, so Peter, I would distinguish between, the key principles that were set out in their communications and the way in which they may have either been expressed or received, if I can put it that way. I think most people would have no problem with the principles concerned, but clearly the way in which they were either communicated or received undermined trust levels between the parties. And we recognize and acknowledge that in the absence of trust, it is very difficult for the president to, if you like, spearhead a sort of radical transformation agenda, which is really what we need to do as the country. And therefore, I believe that, it is important, and we've sort of heard this over the last few days, for people to reflect on not the form, but the substance, if you like, of the issues that are being focused upon. I'm not talking about how to co-govern. I'm talking about the principles that underpin economic growth. And with that, we are, I think, completely ad idem, but so, I believe, are many of the key leaders within the ANC.
And so was it personalities on the DA side? Were they being too insulting, rude, scoring cheap points? Was that what you're saying, that's what you saw and that's what concerned you?
Well, I think what we have seen, and I'm not going to sort of criticize either the DA or the ANC on this call, I think that's constructive. What I think we have seen are issues that are ventilated in the public domain that actually should be discussed behind closed doors and in the right sort of environment, which will, pardon me, result in a sort of satisfactory, constructive and collaborative exchange. And we all know that when we start seeing these exchanges in the public domain, it is very easy for, as you've characterized it, point scoring to emerge, for criticism that is inappropriate criticism from any party to be interpreted. And I think that it doesn't take us forward. What it does is it undermines trust in the individuals, yeah, in the parties, and indeed in government, because those of us on the outside looking in just see a fight. You know, it's very difficult to, yeah, discern, you know, who is appropriately positioning themselves in that exchange. I think that 99% of the country simply want the very things we're all committed to, which is, as I said, you know, addressing poverty and inequality and unemployment through inclusive economic growth, which is where the private sector has a real role to play.
Martin, I'm interested in this notion of inclusive growth because the president talks about it all the time. And inclusive growth is a term that arose in the 80s in Europe, in the UK. In fact, the first person I heard use it was Will Hutton, who you remember from, yes, your time in Britain. I think he was briefly editor of The Observer and an academic who focuses on political economies. And he used inclusive growth in the context of companies bringing the labor force into the shareholding. In other words, giving workers shares in the company, taking risks together, profiting together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In South Africa, it doesn't mean that, does it? I mean, inclusive growth here basically involves what you would call transformation, right? So you grow the economy and transform it at the same time. In other words, color-wise, more black people involved in the economy, more black people running companies, making decisions, investing, et cetera, et cetera. Except that what's happened here, Martin, is that we're doing the transformation without the growth. There is no growth here. And he's, you know, and I wondered what your view of this was. I mean, is transformation a barrier to growth, or does growth depend on transformation, or does one come before the other, and have we got it the wrong way around?
I think there are two separate considerations, Peter. One is, I think that inclusive growth means that the large swathe of those who are unemployed and at the moment living in completely unacceptable circumstances, so the poor and the unemployed, need to be brought along and incorporated and integrated into a growth trajectory in the country. There's no point in 20% of the country getting richer and 80% of the country getting poorer. And we understand that that contributes, quite independent of the morality of it, that contributes to political instability, which we cannot afford. We can't have a situation where we've got, you know, over 40% of the workforce that is actually unemployed, or nearly 60% of the youth that are unemployed. So inclusive growth, in my mind, means that growth has to have and take into consideration the interests of those at its center. At the same time, and you're absolutely correct to raise the sort of transformation agenda, have we made mistakes in our quest to ensure, in particular, that those who've been disadvantaged, primarily but not only, black, colored, Indian, South Africans, can participate fully in the economy? I think we recognize that although we've made progress, it's woefully inadequate relative to, if you like, the demographics of the country. And that also contributes to social instability, again, independent of, you know, the morality of the issue. And therefore, that we absolutely need to make sure, as you said, that workforce is included to the extent it's possible or appropriate in the share register. And we've seen many, many examples of that by the biggest companies in South Africa doing employee share ownership programs, that the communities within which they operate, or the supply chain that they rely upon, or the customer base that they sell to, and in particular, those that have been disadvantaged, also have an alignment of interests in the economic prosperity of the country. Now, it's very easy to say, and very difficult to achieve. And what is clear is that although we're 30 years into democracy, we're a long way from achieving that goal yet. You will know, Peter, that we set with the president when we launched phase two of the partnership as a minimum target of 3% growth, which we're a long way from getting to today. And unfortunately, because of the steps taken by the United States, we probably lost or could lose another 0.5% of GDP growth. And the reason we picked 3% is that at anything less than 3%, unemployment increases. In other words, in excess of 3% is required to make a meaningful impact upon the level of unemployment in the country. And that must be at the very center of any objectives with respect to inclusive growth.
Except, Martin, that, I mean, you're not choosing, you know, you're not doing the hard bit, which is what you would do in the private sector. You're not choosing. You have inclusivity and you have growth, and you're chucking them all into the same pot. And the answer is the same all the time. No growth, no growth, no growth. I don't know about the inclusivity. As you say, the numbers of the poor increase rather than decrease. Surely it's up to the state, or maybe you as an interlocutor, to make the point that something has to change. And possibly, you know, particularly in a year like this, where now because of Trump, you know, the gap that we have, the fiscal gap that we're trying to cover with a VAT increase, will have increased by October, not decreased. It'll get worse, and we'll have the same fight again if the DA stays in power. Surely the only way out of this is growth before anything else, because growth is, you know, it's what we haven't tried. We haven't just gone for growth. We haven't gone for straight growth and, you know, forget about the inclusivity. What's it feel like to grow? Yeah.
So, Peter, I won't disagree with you, because that is absolutely at the core of the partnership. All we're focusing on are constraints on growth. How do we relax those constraints, take the brake off, and make sure that we can power up the private sector, which we believe, by the way, is the key to growth. And when I talk about the private sector, that's not big business.
Well, I agree with
that. That's not big business. In most countries, it's micro and small and medium-sized enterprises, formal or informal. That is the constraint. And everything else must follow that. We are absolutely at it, and you and I on that.
Do you think Cyril Ramaphosa's reforms are going to do the trick? There is, you know, there's been movement on energy, obviously. There's finally some movement on rail and ports, but it's really slow, and it isn't going to be there this year, and probably not there next year either. But we do know for sure that we need fixed capital formation. That's basically investment in production. North of 25% a year of GDP. A year, Cyril was celebrating achieving half of that over 4 years in his first term with all his investment conferences, where all of business was there cheering and clapping along. And it was all fake, Martin.
Yeah, so we have made the very points that you're making now, obviously, to the government, generally behind closed doors. We think that the reforms that you're talking about, whether it's in transportation, or whether it's in energy, you'll see the same thing happening with water. We're going to have to do it with local government. These are all inhibitors that need to be addressed. Unfortunately, you will know that it takes a long time to get consensus, let alone to implement the decisions. And that's where we're trying to be. We can't take the decisions. These are all political decisions. Having the PA on the opposition benches doesn't help take political decisions, by the way. I mean, it may, you know, hold people to account. We have to take those decisions, and we have to implement them as quickly as possible. And we have to temper expectations and moderate what people would like to happen as quickly as possible, because unfortunately it takes time. But I'm pretty clear in Vulindlela 1.0 and 2.0 that the right interventions have been identified across all of those areas that we have talked about, and that we need to push forward as quickly as possible. You know, do we think that it's wide enough and fast enough? No, in both cases, Peter. We make our views clear publicly, by the way, about that as well. But we'd rather make the progress we're making than no progress at all. And it is markedly different, Peter, from any conversation you and I might have had 3 or 4 years ago, when, frankly, these reforms were not on the agenda and were not being implemented.
Martin, just to finish, what do we do about Donald Trump? I mean, is it this? You know, it's probably a pretty stupid question because everyone's asking it. Nobody's got an answer. You know, there's a lunatic in the White House. How does the world respond to this man?
Well, I don't know whether it's the world or South Africa because I was there only a week ago. And as you say, it is really quite extraordinary the pace at which things are either being done or undone, if I can put it that way, with high levels of unpredictability. But there's no doubt that at the end of the day, the president of the United States, you know, whether he was, you know, whether we like it or not, was elected by a majority of those who cast their votes.
Yep.
And is able to now push through pretty radical decisions at a great cost to countries around the world and to individuals, particularly those who are the most impoverished, as we all know. But I think that we need to recognize, and this is a question for you as much as for your listeners, we need to recognize that we have to work with the United States of America. They are too significant and strategic a partner for us to turn our back on. And I believe that, you know, the government needs to be very clearly cited on that. And we need to find a way in which we can work with them without in any way undermining our own sovereignty or alienating other strategic partners around the world. And that's easy for me to say, and no doubt very difficult for the government to do. But the reality is that unless something happens that you and I, you know, can't imagine right now, we've got this for the next 4 years. And we better get used to it, and we better be proactive in dealing with it, not reactive.
My model in all of this is Mark Carney, the current Canadian Prime Minister, which is just not to engage Trump until he deals with you with some respect. But Martin, listen, thank you very much for joining. I really appreciate your time and your input and what you said. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much for your time.
For coming on. And thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcasts on the Edge. Until then, be safe and take care. Bye-bye.